Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Morena, you're on the listening to the Quarter Bananas radio show on this beautiful Sunday. And we are here with Sian, and we are going to be listening to Fem Rants.
Morena, listeners. Warm welcome to you on this beautiful morning. Just reflecting how different it always is in Nainai to Wellington. It is like a very warm, sunny day in beautiful Te Nainai. And I love Wellington, but it's just that little bit cooler in here. And today, this morning, we have a very special guest in the studio, which is my beautiful big dog, Bert, who just needed to be in company this morning. He is an older boy, and he is he has developed dementia, and my lovely partner is a night worker and also has been unwell this week, and I just didn't want to leave a barking dog at home, so I brought him in. But as queer people and lesbians and takatāpui folk and people under our beautiful rainbow umbrella know, we love our dogs.
And our cats.
Kia ora kura, and our cats. What's your cat's name, kura?
Fangy Fathead.
Amazing.
Yes. And
we love the great names for our cats also. Kura is a very, very dedicated cat person. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But probably all animal person, really.
All animals, persons. And Kura and I went to an amazing gig last week, which was Diva Mahal. So I'm sitting here in my beautiful Diva Mahal t-shirt that Kura got me.
It's beautiful.
Isn't that good? Yeah. So I'm looking very fresh and cool. So just want to recommend that new Diva Mahal album to everyone, which I believe is called, New Future Classic. Yeah.
Mm. It was a great concert. I'm glad you invited me. It was just awesome. Yeah. Good boogieing.
Good boogieing, and lots of musicians who've been around a while in the Wellington scene. So it was just a really good reminder of how amazing the music scene is here in Whanganui Atara, and a big encouragement to all of us to get out and listen to some live music. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. And the venue was great too. It was a great venue, that Miao Nui.
Miao Nui, yeah, very atmospheric, very beautiful, and very brightly coloured painted toilets, which I really appreciate. Now, I think, have you got some music? Have you got a tune for
us? I've got some tunes for us today.
Amazing. What are we going to listen to first, Kura?
Well, the first song I'm going to listen to now is Third World, 1978 song, Now That We've Found Love. It's taken so long, but here we go. I'm going to right now.
Music.
Morena e te whānau. So that was Kura's favourite song.
Favourite.
So when we were at the gig, I said, Kura, hey, why don't you choose the music for our next show? Because Kura is a big music fan and we often see each other at the amazing WOMAD. So all music today is Kura's choice. Yeah. I'm Sian Quinnell Torrington. You're on the Femme Rants show on Access Radio 106.1 FM. And today we've got an interview for you that I pre-recorded with Laura McConnell Conti, who you'll hear introduced in the interview. And just last night I was thinking about how timely and important this interview is. I was at a party, wonderful party, and lots of straight people, and the theme was the 1920s. So what that meant was it was pretty gender binary. Like, there was lots of men in suits and there was lots of women or femme presenting people in sort of sparkly dresses. And I had a gender meltdown. I just went, I just can't. It was like, I can't exist in this space. Like, I don't understand myself. I feel like I don't belong. I don't make sense. And there are a couple of other queer, trans and non-binary people there, and just kind of glued myself to them and showed them the extra special bits of my outfit because I felt safe with them. I felt good with them. I felt like I could be myself and be a little bit playful. And they said to me, oh, well, what do you wish was happening here? And I said, well, I think what I need is for the male and masculine people who are wearing suits, I need them to put on some of the sparkly things that the women and femme people are wearing and take off the jackets, and I need it to be all a bit more mixed up. So that was kind of what I was thinking of and dreaming of. So it was just a great reminder to me of how we need other people who are like us, I think what I want to say more than that is we need that diversity. I was like, ooh, I'm in a not very diverse kind of gender space, and that makes me feel like I can't really exist here. So this interview, I just really wanted to bow down to this person for their courage to exist in a space where they couldn't really exist either, and find something different. So here's our interview for today, Whānau.
Okay. Cool. So, kia ora. We're here with the Femme Rants show with Sian Quinnell Torrington, and today I have a wonderful guest, Laura McConnell Conti, who's come to talk to us about cults and her lived experience and conversations that she has around this phenomenon that we have in our world. So really, really warm welcome to you, Laura. Thank you so much for talking to us. And would you like to just introduce yourself for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me, Sian. I'm Laura McConnell Conti. I am a survivor of a high control group or a cult known as the 2x2s. I'm Australian. You'll probably pick that up from my accent. I'm from a rural regional area here in Australia, so my experiences are a lot outside the urban, although I do live urban now. I'm a queer survivor of that group. I've been out for about 26 years. I support other people who are thinking about leaving, who have left, or navigating the world outside, both predominantly the 2x2s and predominantly either women or queer people and young people. I'm a podcast host myself, so love your show, anyone who does this kind of work is much appreciated. It's like a podcast called Truth 2x2 Cult Kids, I'm on various social media platforms like TikTok and Instagram predominantly, just talking about you know, what the group is, what it's like to leave a group like that. And I advocate for law reform here in Australia on coercive control and group coercive control to try and get some change in the way survivors from cults are treated and the ways cults are dealt with legally. So thanks for having me.
Oh, wow. I really feel very honoured and lucky to be able to talk to you. I was really affected by the podcast that I listened to. Very, very moving. And I mean, just inspiring. Just it kind of knocked me out, to be honest. So I'm just wondering if I can start with a probably very complex question, but for our listeners, what is a cult? What are we talking about here, Laura?
Yeah, great question, John. I think it's a very misunderstood concept as well. And I think a lot of the movies and TV shows out there can glamorise what a cult is. And not always mislead people. I don't think they do it on purpose because, you know, you need eyeballs on these shows. But cults are not always what people imagine them to be. And, of course, you've got Gloria Bower in New Zealand, and that's obviously a very obvious example of a cult. But in this work, we like to refer to it as a behaviour rather than a belief system. And it's obviously there is also cultic kind of belief structures, but mostly it's about the way behaviour happens and it's coercive and it's high control. And these are not all religious either. There is a misunderstanding that most cults are religious. And in actual fact, in my journey of working and advocating in this space, I've met as many people who are survivors of non-religious cults as I have religious. Of course, you know, many of the well-known ones do have religious overtones, but it's not actually about religious belief. It's actually about the ways their behaviours that go along with it. You will have learned, I'm sure, there, as we have here in Australia, about coercive control in relationships, and many of the similar dynamics exist in cults, just in a group setting. Usually there are leaders who basically use the same kind of techniques to control people underneath them and around them, as happens in abusive relationships. So essentially cults are a set of high control behaviours. There's people like Dr. Daniel Lalich, who in America, who's, you know, got great checklists for sort of working through what is a cult. And it's things like appearance control, thought control, inability to make decisions for yourself. And as I'm ticking through these things, you'll sort of be thinking, oh, they're not religious, are they? These things are not about belief structures that come out of necessarily out of a Bible or a book or a manual, in the case of yoga or wellness. It's actually about the ways that they're implemented on the ground. So, yeah, we like to say that a cult is essentially a high-control group that controls people with coercive tactics.
Thank you so much. That's so useful. Yes, my beautiful meditation teacher was always, I've worked out that the people I trust to guide me are like, they're like the complete opposite to that. So he would always say, you do not need a special cushion. You do not need a special outfit. You just sit down and practice. That's it. And he would also always say something that other teachers of mine have said, which is, take what feels useful, and anything that doesn't feel useful for you, just drop it. And
critical thinking is important in that, isn't it? Like giving people space to think critically about things, to ask questions and be challenged. And that's one of the key things we find in these groups. Not only is there not mechanisms to ask questions or mechanisms to take what leave, what works and what doesn't, but you're actively punished for not doing, for asking questions. So you'll often find, in all kinds of groups, people will be shunned or excommunicated or pushed out or socially isolated, or, you know, there will be consequences for not having the right to cushion or not wearing the right thing. So, it's actually that the more you look into these kinds of behaviours, the more you realise actually it could happen in any environment. It does. It happens in all kinds of environments, sporting clubs, meditation, yoga, wellness, you know, mentoring, religion. It's everywhere.
Absolutely. And it's so helpful to hear you describe those sort of coercive techniques and control and that sort of that human need we have to want to be part of a group and to belong and the way that that can be used in coercive ways to control people. Yeah,
absolutely. It is a human need, isn't it, for connection and community. And it's about understanding how to do that safely, because, you know, we should not be taking away people's ability to connect, and nor would we want to take away people's ability to get married or have relationships in a domestic violence setting that's not an outcome you would want. We also don't want to take away connection or community from people in the process of busting open and shutting down cults.
Absolutely. And can you tell us the particular cult that you grew up in, the name or anything you want to share about that?
Sure, yeah. Well, I was raised in the 2x2s, which claims to have no name, actually, and so it's been very hard to actually have open conversations about who the group is in places like Australia and New Zealand as well, because they have large followings all around the world. When I say larger, I mean they are a relatively small group, but they're larger than people realise. They are bigger than the likes of Gloria Vale, but people have not necessarily heard of them. They are known in our region predominantly as the Truth or the Way or the Fellowship, and out of the US and Canada, they've become the commonly known as the 2x2s because of the way that our preachers go out in pairs around, and they stay in people's homes. So they became known as the 2x2s. So I think at its height here in Australia, there would have been around 15,000 followers, and probably somewhere around 10 in New Zealand, 10,000 that is. So, you know, compared to lots of high control groups, they are relatively large and unknown. Very fundamentalist Christian belief structure, so high control Christian belief structure, much like other high control groups, the Plymouth Brethren, the Glory Vale, a very, very conservative interpretation of the King James Bible, and a very patriarchal structure, essentially, with men in leadership positions and women in very subservient kind of roles, and a lot of space for anyone to behave in ways which doesn't tightly align to their ideology. So yeah, I was raised in that group. Most of us are multi-generational. I was raised fifth generation on my mother's side and third generation my father's, so I didn't know really anybody else except the people in that group, which is not uncommon. Most of us are raised in quite insular environments, often large families, although families are a little smaller these days. So I had a lovely childhood in lots of ways, and I had lots of cousins and siblings and whatnot. But I just didn't really know anybody outside. And so leaving for me was particularly difficult and isolating, because I came from a rural area, as I said before, and came from this community where I just didn't really know anybody else. So the world outside was a terrifying place. And that's not uncommon in these groups. They really teach people, you know, an us and them mentality, that outside is, you know, you keep yourself separate from people, interact when you need to. So I went to a mainstream school, for instance, public school, but didn't really, you know, have connections and friends. And girls, you know, we were allowed to do sports and participate in extracurricular things. So really, we lived quite, you know, separate to mainstream society.
It sounds really isolating. Yeah,
I mean, in lots of ways it was wonderful too, you know, like we the group tends not to openly have TV and radio and pop music, although these days they do have laptops and mobile phones. They do have more access to the kind of pop culture than they used to, but I grew up entirely isolated from pop culture. No idea about TV shows, no idea about music. So it's like another world, you know, these are closed places inside. They're a world within a world.
Wow. And Laura, I'm wondering, what is it like? What is it like as a queer person being in that environment? I mean, my head just spins thinking about that. Yeah.
So we don't exist. We don't exist. Right. There is not space for such things. There's not vocabulary for such things. We really, girls in particular, were groomed to sort of find a spouse within the group. It's a little harder now in most parts of the world, because the group is much smaller, to marry somebody you're not related to. So there are people who are a little bit more kind of interested in marrying outside and converting people in, but certainly we were encouraged to marry within the group. We were, you know, we were set up with a spouse very young. There was sort of a compulsory heterosexuality. There was just a very tight purity culture as well, so no sex before marriage, no exploration whatsoever. A lot of shame around sexuality and very strict gender roles. And so we were just expected to marry somebody quite young, to find somebody to marry very young, and to have children very young. So there was never any space really to even explore concepts of not wanting, you know, to marry a man as a girl. And I knew very young that I did not want to get married. I knew very young that I did not, had no interest in having children. So it just made me odd right from, you know, as young as I can remember, I was very odd because I was not interested in boys the same way that my cousins were. My cousins around me, yeah, found their spouse very young. Like, you know, I'm talking 13, 14. They were already, you know, kind of, they had already decided who they were going to marry. And I just wasn't ever interested. I liked boys intellectually in that, you know, I found them stimulating and I wanted to have conversations and I wanted to be their equal. And that just set me completely apart from as young as I can remember. I wanted to be like them, you know, like I wanted to wear trousers. We were not allowed to wear trousers because that, you know, was outside of our belief system. We were not allowed to cut our hair. And, you know, it's just very defined roles for boys and girls. And I didn't like the role that was set out for me at all. And that was obvious, very young, but no space, no words, no vocabulary, just, yeah, I just did not belong. But of course, yeah, there's no way for that to go. Like in our culture, it was you got married and had children or you joined our clergy. Mm-hmm. I also was very clearly not going to sit to the clergy either, right? Like I wasn't going to be a worker, which is what we call our clergy. There was just no way for me to be and no words for that. But, you know, it never bothered me per se. Like people say, oh, they must have been quite traumatic. And I look back, I think I find it sad now, but I never remember being bothered by it. I was like, well, that's just what I am, and I'm okay with that. I was always just okay with it. And I suppose I just maybe a little bit oblivious to how obviously queer and different I was.
And it
resulted in me being kicked out at the end of the day because I couldn't articulate, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, you couldn't do what you had to do to be in that environment.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
And I mean, it makes me think about how lots of queer people have, you know, we can have really, really rich inner worlds, can't we? Especially when people live rurally or people are isolated for lots of different reasons, and we know who we are, but in a very inner kind of way.
And we can be very creative people as well. You know, there was no space for creativity. There was no space for exploration or curiosity. Mm-hmm. Wow. Things were shut down, you know. And so I did. I lived this kind of rich booky world where I read all the time, and I was desperate to learn about people's lives outside of my own, you know. It was a very, very rich kind of imaginative life that I had created for myself. But, you know, I also credit, you know, I loved community and I loved people and I loved the fact that I was from a place and from people and from that. And I, you know, I take that very rich kind of understanding that I was never, ever alone, you know.
Yes.
And there's lots of that community I'm grateful for, even though I'm very, very clearly very different.
So how did you find community in the outside world? So when you were, as you say, kicked out of this community, how did you find queer community? How did you learn about, I love your words, building a life outside with joy and pleasure. How did you begin?
Well, I there was no place for me, as I said, that I didn't realise that really, and I decided I wanted to get an education, and I wanted to go to university, and so I took myself off from the community myself and left behind siblings, and I had been a carer as well. I had, you know, girls in particular were expected to care for the children, and so I made a very big decision that I would leave and go to the city and get an education, and it was really at that point that I became very uncomfortable. It just wasn't something that was done in my community. Especially, I had decided I wanted to study women's studies, of all things. And people go, oh, this is just the most incongruous kind of decision for someone from a closed community to decide to leave and then go and study women's studies. But, yeah, I sort of just was desperate to understand my own life and my own, like, I just, and I wanted to be around similar people who wanted to understand. And I stumbled upon a Germaine Greer book, of all things. She's just not exactly my good books these days, but I'd stumbled upon that, and I just was desperate to learn more about feminism and about women's lives. And so, yeah, I came to Melbourne and started studying feminism. It was at that point that I was really excommunicated not long after that. Wow. But it was through that degree that I guess I found place and found, a way forward in the world. And in lots and lots of ways, it's how I ended up in advocacy and how I ended up doing the podcast to begin with. Because it taught me my experiences were valuable. It taught me vocabulary to describe what had happened and what continued to happen for me. It meant I had connections and I had some even slight way to build a new community and to build a new life. And then I went on to study business and finance as well and go on and have a career in that as well. So, of course, then I was able to get a job. And lots of people who leave these kinds of groups, finding work and finding housing was very difficult. So in lots of ways I was very privileged. Not sure that I would be so lucky if I was leaving today, put that way.
And, yeah, I mean, that's so powerful to hear you describe finding a language to speak about and understand what had happened to you, what continued to happen to you. And, thank you for sharing that. I'm thinking about coming from that environment of coercive control. Can you talk to us about what is it like to try and understand consent in the outside world when you come out of that kind of environment? Where did you even begin?
Yeah, we weren't, and many people I still think are not, and that's not just in cults, that's in general. Yeah. Understanding of consent and bodily autonomy and the idea that you own your own body and that you can say no to me. And of course the relationships I came from and the kinds of community I came from, just relationships were so dysfunctional in that nobody, women, there were very strict roles for women. You couldn't stand up to your role in that, and that's not just sexually and with regard to things like reproduction and conception, but like also, when it comes to like your role in caring for children and your role in finances. So, there are many who do not have, access to their own money and access to their own bank accounts. Many young people who grow up not understanding that they can ask for their parents not to be on their bank account, that they can have access to their own car registration. Consent is not just about sex. It's also about, access to your own finances, access to your own, your own rights and your own autonomy. We just had no idea that those things were things that we had rights to. We just were raised to believe that we would get married and that we would have children, and that was our role and that was what God wanted from us, and that was the best way to show our devotion and to demonstrate that we had the right spirit, was to follow instructions and not to ask questions and not to have curiosity and not to have our own opinions. I was never somebody who could fit that mold to begin with, so I guess I'm very lucky in that in lots of ways for me, consent wasn't that much of a stretch, because I did always have a pretty big mouth and I was always pretty vocal about not wanting certain things. But that made me a troublemaker. I was framed as a troublemaker instead of somebody who had rights. I was framed as an outlier. Abuse in these groups is just rife. There's just abuse of many, many kinds in these groups. And so we have very traumatized people and intergenerational trauma as well. We have very, very big issues with mental health. You just have this cycle of people who can't understand that it's not okay to be abused and that it's okay to say no. And if you're in a structure that believes it is the only way, you actually grow up believing that, sure, there's some of this stuff that isn't right, but I have to tolerate this because this is the right way, and it may not be perfect, but it's the right way, and if I leave, well, I'm going to hell, so I've got to tolerate the pain in here to protect me from going to hell. And some of the worst things are covered up under the guise of it being the only true way. I'm doing the little rabbit ears here, but it's the only true way. And so you have to suffer for these things to get into heaven. And then add a culture that does think it's all God's plan. And so if you suffer, then you're suffering for God, for God's saving. And so you will pass up your own autonomy and your own, you will give away consent because you think, well, that's the only way to get to heaven. And so, they're still common for me to have conversations with people who do not understand that consent exists and that they have rights and that they can say no.
Yeah, I mean, I was absolutely, I was really struck in the episode that I listened to. You were talking about the kink community and how it's so based in consent and everything you do. It doesn't have to be sexual. It can be playful. It could be tickling someone with a feather. But, you know, do you want this? Where do you want this? Kind of level of consent, where when I'm in those sorts of spaces, I always feel so much safer than I do in any kind of bar or on the street, or because it's actively being talked about. Hey,
correct. It needs little. I mean, often it's so prescriptive that it doesn't need a lot of space for play. You have to actually say, like, I'm not sure if I like that. You need to actually make space to give that. You know, that, like, maybe, because, yeah, it is actually a great place for people who haven't understood consent, because you need, and communication. Like, we're not taught to communicate needs. We're not taught to communicate desire. We're not taught to even explore. It gives permission to be like, yes, no. And then the thing that's probably most difficult for us is maybe, I'm not sure. Yeah. You know, because we're used to this black and white world of, like, yes, no.
Yes, and I really love that learning of, you can also say no at any time. You can say yes and then try something out and go, oh, actually, no, not now, or not like that, or just no. And I think that's something that we need a lot more of in our culture is it doesn't have to be yes or no, and then that's it for the next however long. Yeah.
It's not a once-off. Consent is a constant conversation, which in itself is confronting for especially people who've not been taught to communicate needs or to ask questions or to have curiosity. The idea that you can have an ongoing conversation, and this is not just a, like, no, done, never again, or also a, yes, this is forever, you know, like the permanency is not there with the consent. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I was 36 when I met my current partner, and I remember having sex for the first time together and them saying to me, what do you want? What do you like? And I just burst into tears because no one had ever asked me that question before.
Yeah.
And I've been having sex since I was 16, you know? Yeah. And it's like, really? Wow. Yeah, it is really confronting.
Yeah, to center you, it's centering yourself in that as well, which is very confronting as well. It's not only being after and then having to think, well, what do I like? But like this centering of like, oh, I'm allowed to actually think about that without shame. You know, it shuts down this, like, complete shame. Like, I have needs and I have desires and I have, like, wow, that's a thing. Okay.
Yeah. I think before, for me, it had always been a performance. Like, you know, what does the other person need me to perform for them to feel good? And it was that moment of, realizing all of that from such a direct, beautiful question. Yeah.
Gorgeous.
Laura, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about your advocacy work that you do with people, with survivors and leavers.
I've been very lucky in the past 12 to 18 months to connect up with a wider group of survivors of different kinds of fight control groups and cults here in Australia and New Zealand, for that matter, as well. Advocate together for inter-parliament, specifically in the state I'm here in Australia, in Victoria, to get an inquiry underway to look into the ways that cults and high control groups are operating in this state, which we hope that we'll be able to roll out some more things in other states in Australia, to think about incorporating the kinds of laws that we have in states here for coercive control in relationships to also apply to cults, to try and get more support services, really, for cult leavers and people who are thinking about leaving and rebuilding or building a new life. Because there just is not enough services here in Australia for survivors. You know, if we have a housing crisis just in general, but housing is very hard for survivors. Employment is very hard. Access to therapy is very difficult. And the right kinds of therapy. A lot of the advocacy I do is now with survivors and victims here in Australia, just more broadly, which really changes the conversation. Because for many years, I did a lot of this sort of advocacy on my own, just trying to fight for services for 2x2 survivors. And now it's like, actually, this is bigger than just my group. And, you know, there's this great sort of group of people who have similar issues. I mean, we often laugh about the playbook being the same. Copy, paste, change the name. Copy, paste, change the name.
Yeah.
You know, and what comes out the other side is just often the same thing with a different name. You know, damaged people trying to build a new life without support. So, yeah, I'm spending a lot of time on that at the moment, building online communities for that, putting up a charity here in Australia, yeah, to get some support services funded for people, and advocating into Parliament, which is, you know, it's a pinch-me sort of thing. Sometimes I think, gosh, is this the same kid who left that group at 19 with kind of no idea about the world outside? Apparently it is.
Well, I mean, from what you've shared with us today, I think what I hear is a person with a sort of fire in her belly and a curiosity and a beautiful, I mean, you said a big mouth, and I think, yay, thank goodness for that beautiful big mouth out there doing the advocacy and, doing this really, really important work. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. And, you know, it's an honour to be able to share some of these experiences, especially from queer kids' experiences as well, because, you know, I do think so many come out with shame and no language or vocabulary to describe who they are, what they've come from, and then what life might look like for a queer kid on the other side of a high-control group. You know, there's not only the layers of confusion and ostracisation that often happens in families, but then there's a whole, you know, a whole community which is also, you know, behaving in ways which is very confronting. So it is an honour, really, to be able to help people get some vocabulary and find their feet.
Mm. Well, we really appreciate you talking to us today, and I will share the link to your amazing podcast, and particularly those couple of episodes that are directly about queerness and and survival as queer people. And, we would say here a huge mihi to you, so a huge acknowledgement and gratitude to you for sharing your stories and for all the support work that you're doing for other people, and for your joy and pleasure that you have found.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. It's lovely to meet you.
Yeah, you too.
Morena whānau. You're with the Fem Rants show with Sian and Kura and Bert, the Huntaway dog. So that was our interview with Laura McConnell-Conti, who makes the podcast Truth 2x2 Cult Kids. So that was a pre-record from a couple of days ago, and just about her podcast. It's a resource for survivors of the unnamed cult, which is often referred to as the Truth. But the conversation is important for anyone who grew up with religious fundamentalism. And it's the podcast aims to open up a conversation about healthy sexuality for cult survivors. So really recommend the podcast actually to anyone who's interested in this topic. I listened to, there's a couple of episodes that in particular talk about queer sexuality, finding our pleasure, finding who we are, working out what consent is, and being on that ongoing journey. I really learned a lot from that episode. I found it very inspiring, very moving. So I'm pretty sure it's episode 15, but we will look it up and pop it on the Facebook. So that's Laura McConnell-Conti, and she's talking to Christine Wanaka, who also grew up in this cult, and who both work having these kind of conversations and doing advocacy for other survivors. And it made me think a lot about queer people and how there's a lot for us all about finding out who we are and building communities that make us feel good and supported. So, Kura, have we got another waiata?
Yep, so that was a very interesting interview. Thank you for sharing that. The next song is Hold On by Yola and the Highway Women.
Mama said to me, hold on, you gotta be wise. Hold on, momentary dreams can be gone. Oh, water through your fingers you can't hold. Baby, hold on to the things that you love. Show me.
Listening to Femme Rants on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM.
Kia ora, thank you, Kura. What a perfect waiata after our interview. That was really, really beautiful. Thank you. So I really wanted to spend the rest of the show talking about community notices and therefore opportunities for us to get out and be in queer, trans, non-binary, rainbow, takatāpui, beautiful community with other people. And I just wanted to give a shout out to any and all of our listeners who aren't in Wellington, who might be in the Wairarapa or Invercargill or Hawke's Bay or wherever you're listening, and to say we would love to hear about what's going on in your places. So I know that when I came out, I was living only just up on the Kapiti Coast, but didn't know anyone else who was queer apart from my my girlfriend, but we need more than that. And this radio show, which was lesbian radio show at the time, was the thing that I had that I listened to. And I listened to these community notices and found out about stuff going on. So you can contact us. We're on Facebook. And, flick us a message. You can look us up on the Access Radio page. We would love to do phone interviews around the country, hear about what else is going on around Aotearoa. So I've got a few things to recommend. There's a stage show by Angie Kreft coming up. So this is in Wellington from the 30th of April to the 2nd of May at Bats Theatre, and it's called Staunch, a compelling one-woman performance written and performed by Angie Kreft, an intimate and heartfelt work exploring love, laughter and discovery, reflecting on her relationship with her mother and the powerful truths revealed after her passing. So that's coming up soon, next week, that looks like, at Bats. Always worth checking out the program at Bats Theatre. It's really amazing. That's my puppy with dementia. There's a new queer poet called Toni Spencer, she/her, who is a writer and artist living in Tāmaki Makaurau. Her kaupapa could be summed up as trust the chaos. Love it. So her first novel, Origami War, was published by queer US publishing house Nine Star Press in 2022. And this April, we'll see the publication of Toni's debut illustrated poetry collection, Fever Dream, which is about... Oh my goodness, it's an entire book of poems written in one day, which started as a joke but turned it into a kind of exorcism. 18 hours of writing without stopping. They have since been professionally edited, and Toni has used her visual art skills to illustrate them throughout. I'm just going to pass my dog over to Kura so that he can have a very skilled, beautiful head massage on the other side of the desk. And we've really got lots of amazing things coming up, whānau. We've got the New Zealand International Comedy Festival coming up, and Eddie Izzard is going to be here. So that is very exciting. So this is the Sunday, the 24th of May in Wellington. So... it's called The Remix, a chance for Eddie, inspired by her ever-loyal audiences, to remix and reimagine some of her own favourite personal comedy highlights. Eddie Izzard is also doing Hamlet in Wellington, which I'm hoping to be able to go and see. That will be amazing. That was on in London while we were away up there. The Comedy Festival has mini festivals happening in Kapiti, Petaone and Porirua, so worth checking that out. Some local brilliant queers are also making shows, just a little selection here. One of mine and Kura's favourites, Ginger Minge, are doing a show called Redemption. We went to one of their shows. Kura's just laughing on the other side of the desk. That was chaotic and brilliant. That's 15th and 16th of May. Then we have, I remember we had Lily Catastrophe come in and talk about her show, which sounded absolutely fantastic. That's on the 6th to the 9th of May. It's called Little Sister. So that's a wonderful queer and trans comedian. We have Sarah Tuck, Six Figure Clown. That's from the 12th to the 16th of May. Sarah just came and modelled for our queer and trans drawing class last week, which was awesome. Six Figure Clown is a sharp, silly reckoning with ambition, success, and making it up as you go. Prepare for an uproar of characters, mime, and sketch comedy. This is for anyone who's ever come out, burned out, or had a hard day in policy. So yeah, I know Sarah Tuck hasn't made a show for a long time, so there's a lot of excitement and buzz around that show. It will be really worth checking out. So those are just some of the people that I know and recognise, recommends. Then we have coming up, we have Coven Undressed, which is one of my favourite rainbow, queer, women and non-binary, gender minorities spaces. So that currently the tickets, advance tickets are sold out. It's on Saturday the 23rd of May, but there will be tickets on the door. And if you don't already follow Coven and go along to their events, I really, really recommend them. They create beautiful, welcoming spaces for us. And if you don't know anyone, it's a really, really great place to go, because the first hour is like quieter music and getting to know people, and they sit you on tables, and it really actually works. I've made new friends during that time, and they think really hard about how to build communities. So follow Coven. You can always find their events on Event Finder, Facebook, Instagram. They've also got some cabaret events coming up. MILF, the mother of all cabarets, at Fringe Bar, Friday, 5th of June. And then one I'm excited about, Sappho, a deliciously sapphic cabaret. So that's on Friday, the 3rd of July at the Fringe Bar. They basically are running queer events, drag shows, cabaret, dancing once a month in Wellington. So that's Willie Smack and Tush. So Willie Smack, S-M-A-C-K, N Tush, T-U-S-H. And you can find them on Event Finder, Facebook and Instagram. So really, really recommend that we get out of the house and get connected with community. Keep listening to this show. Stay connected, whānau.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.